But when it came to the New England tour, he visited 60 towns and villages alone, and that took a month. The longest one would be the Southern tour, which would be 3 months. It's a joke today, Washington slept here, all this sleeping around. But what he was doing was, by visiting all these towns and staying in these public taverns, this was hard work for him. Part of him enjoyed the travel, but the other part, it was extremely repetitive, arduous in a physical way, and took a lot of time, particularly when we think of our schedules today. Taking 3 months off to tour the South is kind of extraordinary.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the fall of 1789, George Washington, who was only 6 months into his presidency, set out on the first of four road trips as he attempted to unite what were basically 13 independent states into a single nation. To retrace those steps, in the fall of 2018, Nathaniel Philbrick and his wife Melissa set out to retrace Washington's route across the country. By following Washington as he attempted to bring the nation together, traveling as far north as Kittery Point, Maine, and as far south as Savannah, Georgia, he hoped to gain some historical perspective on our own politically divided times. Nathaniel wrote a book about his travels called Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy, and he's today's guest. He learned a lot of the tricks that Washington used when he strode into town to try to show people that, well, he was a man of the people. He stayed in taverns, the 18th century equivalent of roadside motels. He traveled in a modest carriage with no security detail at all and visited local shops, but he also wanted people to celebrate what he represented, a war victory in the United Nation. So sometimes he'd throw on his general's uniform and ride through each town's thoroughfare on his big white horse, Prescott. He also reached across the partisan divide and ventured into what might be considered enemy territory. At time, the interior of Georgia and the Carolinas that strongly opposed the new federal taxes, or Rhode Island, which had only just ratified the Constitution over a year after Washington was elected. What worried Washington above all as he went through a very disunited United States was that he feared if there were a president that would follow him whose chief priority was to divide rather than unite the American people. So we see that Washington's challenges mirror our own today, but he also had unique insight on how to overcome them. There's a lot to unpack here, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Nathaniel Philbrick. Nat, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Well, there is an endless amount of ways to explore the life and activities of George Washington, one of which you got to experience on a very visceral level, and that's retracing the steps of his first presidential tour. So to give an overview of what that was before we dive into the particulars, could you take us through Washington's first of four presidential trips, which he took in 1789? What were the stops? What was his purpose? And what was the ultimate result?
Yeah, well, in October of 1789, not even 6 months after he had been inaugurated, he set out on the first of four presidential tours. And what he was trying to accomplish was he realized there was a danger of him getting very isolated by the American people. And he also realized that the United States was already politically divided. There were Federalists who were for the strong federal government created by the Constitution. And then there were Anti-Federalists who distrusted that strong federal government and wished that the states that had the same level of power they had had under the Articles of Confederation. So, and when Washington was inaugurated, two states, Rhode Island and North Carolina, had not yet ratified the Constitution. So he knew he needed to do something to make people believe in the United States of America as opposed to their town or state. So he set out on the first of a series of road trips, going from the temporary capital of New York to New England. He set out with a retinue, as he called it, of his horse-drawn carriage, pulled by four horses, a baggage wagon, several servants, two of them enslaved, and an aide. And they headed out from New York and would eventually make their way all the way up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He'd get to Kittery Point, Maine, on a harbor tour, and then they would make their way back following a different route back to New York. And he also wanted to make an impression. He was the most popular man in the world at this time, and he had the hope to use that popularity to create a sense of legitimacy for this new federal government. And he also had a sense of theatrics. After 8 years as commander of the Continental Army, he knew how to make an impression. And so before he would come into a town, he would often get out of his carriage dressed in his general's uniform, get on his great big white horse, and ride down Main Street to great acclaim. And this had a truly galvanizing effect on the people. As a newspaper in Salem, Massachusetts would say, the appearance of the president has united all hearts in his favor. And this had not been the case prior to his tour. There had been Federalists and Anti-Federalists who really stated their skepticism for the whole concept of a new federal government. But things had changed once he returned to New York after his New England tour.
I'm curious what people's impression of Washington was before they saw him, because today we're inundated with so many images of the president that our brain gets the sense that we know him, even though we haven't met him before. But people would have not only, of course, seen no video of him, but based on how printing presses worked back then, wouldn't have even seen an illustrated image of him. So what sort of connection do people feel to Washington? Do they just think of him as some sort of political figure that they had heard of and knew him leading the war effort? So what was their sense of Washington before they saw him? And what was the reception that people had of Washington after they saw him and met him or encountered him?
Yeah, well, going into this tour, he was the Revolutionary War hero. And for just about all Americans, he was larger than life. He was, you know, that mythic figure that had somehow led this country against Britain and won the country its independence. And in a way, he was reinforcing that mythology by, you know, these dramatic entrances into a town. But what you also see are people are realizing, whoa, he's just a man. And what's remarkable during that New England tour are the times that anecdotes have been preserved of often children seeing Washington for the first time, or Washington talking to a group of people where he says, I am only a man, or a child standing there slack-jawed saying, he's a man. And this was exactly the message Washington wanted to deliver. Yes, I was led you in the American Revolution, but I am now your president. And as the president of a republic, not a monarch, I am not a dictator. I am one of you who has been elected by you to lead this country. And so he was trying to have it both ways, impress people, but also reinforce that he was like them. And one of the things he did to underline that was to insist on staying only in public taverns. And most people assumed he would stay in the most comfortable quarters he could find, the houses of his rich friends in each town or city. But he didn't want to play favorites, and he also wanted to reinforce this sense of his being one of the people. And so staying in a public tavern in the late 18th century was not fun. They were largely flea-infested, terrible beds, food worse. But Washington felt that this was part of the agenda he needed to have if he was going to bring this message of being a president who is yet one of them.
I suppose it's luxurious if you're comparing it to Valley Forge, but compared to anything modern, not that great. I wonder, based on how much you have been able to reconstruct with his lodgings and how he traveled from stop to stop, it's mind-boggling to compare that to a modern day where days, maybe weeks, I'm not really sure how long before a president would stay somewhere, the Secret Service would come, they would do a sweep of it, make sure that it's secure, then the president stays it. There's multiple agents around them. They have a very tight security protocol. There's basically a flotilla of security that travels with him. So any type of encounter with the public is either very staged, it's for political ops, or under very secure, very controlled circumstances. So based on what you know about that and compared to what you were able to reconstruct of Washington's travels and his lodgings and everything else, were there any particular things that really stuck out to you of just surprising at how modest it was in comparison?
Oh, it's almost unimaginable, the informality of his traveling. He had no security detail. He had one or two aides, depending on the leg of the tour. There's no evidence that they were armed. They probably had some kind of weapon with them, but there was really no concern for that. And he's going from town to town on a horse-drawn carriage. It's not Air Force One. In some instances, when he was returning from Portsmouth to New York, his schedule had not been announced. He was just trying to make as good a time as possible. He was just making his way back to New York. And so he would come into towns completely unannounced. And people would say, whoa, that's General Washington, and make their way out to the tavern where he might be stopping for a meal or something like that. And so the level of informality is kind of astonishing when you look at it today. There would often be local militia who would volunteer to lead his retinue into town. Washington tried to convince people they didn't need to do that. They didn't need the formality and he didn't need the protection, because what he really irritated him was the clouds of dust that the cavalry would kick up in front of him. And so often he would, in the morning, claim that he would be leaving about 10 o'clock or so, for example, and actually leave several hours earlier than that just to avoid having an escort. And so this was a level of informality that is just kind of unimaginable today. And remember, Washington was famous during the Revolutionary War for his personal bravery, for his unwillingness to really take any kind of precautions during a battle. And it almost seems natural that he would take this attitude during his tour of America.
And I know that from what you were able to recount, Washington's diaries are sparse at this time period. So in terms of forensic studies to try to piece together what it was that he said and what it was that he did during this trip, what is your sense of how he engaged with people? What sort of speech did he give, and how did he try to exert political will and achieve his objectives on this trip?
Well, one of the things he made a point of is he wanted to talk with leaders in each community about the issues that were affecting the community, what their attitude was towards the emerging policies of his administration. He was making conscious efforts to talk with people during his tour. He would also often stop and talk to farmers about their crops, planting techniques, these kinds of things. And what we have his diaries, in which he doesn't tell us much detail, but he does outline pretty specifically each stop along the way and those kinds of things. But he also, were recorded the addresses he would get. This would be, for example, coming into Philadelphia, it would be receive an address from the Society of the Cincinnati, from the collective group of religious leaders in the community, from, in the case of Philadelphia, from what's now the University of Pennsylvania, these kinds of things. And then that he would respond in writing to those, often that they were ghostwritten by his aides. So there was this kind of formal back and forth. And then often at night, there would be or in the middle of the day, which was more common just given the times people ate in the late 18th century, there would be lavish dinners, often including a series of toasts, followed by a volleys of cannon fire. And, you know, this was before tweets, but you can look to these toasts as there's information embedded there in which the community is expressing. At one point, for example, Rhode Island had not yet ratified the Constitution when Washington went on his New England tour. And in Worcester, there is a toast looking ahead to the inclusion of Vermont, hoping that before that happens, Rhode Island will choose to include themselves in the Union. And so you have those kinds of messages being sort of formalized through the toast, which might seem very laborious and repetitive to us, but I'm sure Washington was paying distinct attention to what each toast was saying, because they were, in many cases, very important messages being conveyed.
And approximately how long did this tour last, and about how many different locations did he visit?
Well, when it came to the New England tour, he visited 60 towns and villages alone, and that took a month. The longest one would be the Southern tour, which would be 3 months, and the towns were much more spread out in the South, so somewhere in the neighborhood of the New England number. And so this was, you know, it's a joke today. Washington slept here, all this sleeping around. But what he was doing was, by visiting all these towns and staying in these public taverns, this was hard work for him. This was part of him enjoyed the travel, but the other part, it was extremely repetitive, arduous in a physical way. and took a lot of time, particularly when we think of our schedules today. Taking 3 months off to tour the South is kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, this is interesting to see how politics and persuasion gets done in the 18th century. My mental map was thinking that, well, it wouldn't make sense for Washington to travel because presidents largely, if they can, I'm using the analogy of a presidential election, which is different here, but they largely didn't campaign personally. Something like a whistle stop tour where you travel across a nation doesn't really come around to like a William Jennings Bryan in 1896. Travel is extraordinarily difficult at this time in the 18th century, and many of the early projects of America were infrastructure projects of canals and other things to be able to push people along faster, and later on railroads, because the biggest challenge of all this new land in America was being able to successfully traverse it, because travel was very slow at this time. But obviously what Washington did made sense and it worked, and with his political calculus, he was able to influence the right people and leverage them. So from a purely political standpoint, how was he able to be successful? Did he target, all right, I'm going to go to these particular cities which are influential in these states, or in other cases, colonies, to continue, and the nodes of influence are going to be tripped at these different places. So did you get a sense of what the overall strategy was and how he chose different locations?
Well, you know, it varied with each tour. When it was the New England tour, it was early in his first term, and he hadn't even finished creating his cabinet. It wouldn't be until the following March that Thomas Jefferson would become Secretary of State, and Hamilton would begin to come forward with the financial policies that would, in many cases, be very controversial. So, you know, the New England tour was more, you know, here I am, there's this new government in the country, and I am your leader. By the Southern tour, which was more than a year later, many of Hamilton's economic plans, such as the tax on whiskey, which was very controversial in the South, had come into focus. And also the South tended to be comprised of anti-federalists, those who distrusted the whole notion of the Constitution's creation of a strong federal government. And before he even headed South, word came to him that a former governor of North Carolina said he would be happy and honored to meet the general who won us our revolution, but he would not allow President Washington into his home. You know, so there was a dividing line, and clearly this wasn't all going to be a celebration. This was, he had some selling to do. And so when it came to that Southern tour, the first leg was following the coast to the south all the way to Savannah. And he knew that in the large ports of Charleston and Savannah, these were unusual for the South. These were Federalist pockets because these were rice planters who needed the infrastructure of a city, who recognized the importance of taxation to maintain the systems they needed to get their produce to market. And so that was okay. He knew that was going to go all right. But then he headed inland to Augusta, Georgia, and then up through Camden, South Carolina, into Charlotte and Salisbury, Salem, and then eventually back into Virginia. And he knew already there had been discontent voiced about the tax on whiskey. So he knew he was going into a very different political environment. And as he would note, when he encountered people who had problems with his policies, he said once he explained the necessity of them, they seemed reconciled to that. And, you know, he may have been whistling in the dark and, you know, here is President Washington, you're only going to tell him what he wants to hear. But the fact of the matter is, while Western Pennsylvania would erupt in violence over the whiskey tax, a place that Washington did not go to in these presidential tours, the South, there would be pockets of violence when it came to the whiskey tax, but none of what happened in Western Pennsylvania. And perhaps, you know, this was evidence that his tour had some beneficial effects when it came to people reconciling themselves to the policies of his government.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Well, you note that in some areas he's received very well, and then there are other places like the interior of Georgia, the Carolinas, that are almost considered enemy territory. But before getting into the regionality and how strong it was at this time period, I'm curious viscerally about the trip, because you retrace Washington's steps. So can you describe where you went and What sense do you think you gleaned from that of what his trip was like by actually going on part of it?
Yeah, it was interesting. Very different between the New England tour and the Southern tour. Going to New England, you know, many of these New England villages still have their greens so that, you know, and just about, it seemed like every one of these towns had their Washington elm, where during his tour, Washington supposedly paused underneath this the outspread branches of an elm and viewed the beauty of this town and refreshed himself before continuing on. You know, those were traditions that were of dubious authenticity. But the fact is, you could see the landscape in large part that Washington would have seen when it came to these town greens. The roads were obviously very different, often following 1 or 1A, in many cases, miracle miles, where they would have been, you know, small country lanes to our reckoning. But still, you could sense the historical fabric of the late 18th century. You could see visual elements of it today. And then going south, it was very different in terms of, and depending on where we were, in following the coast down, particularly on our way to Charleston after leaving Georgetown, South Carolina, we were able to find some of the roads Washington actually traveled that, because other highways were built, remained pretty much the way they were when he was there. Dirt roads through pine forest for miles. And that was pretty incredible to be driving down those. And you're not seeing exactly what Washington was seeing, because in large part, the longleaf pines that once dominated the South have been completely replaced by loblolly pines that are a different tree. And yet, you know, you still had that sense of these little roads through the pine forests that are still there. And you talk about the regionality of it. It was in the South, outside. You know, you go to Charleston, it's still quite a historic town. There's historic tour guides everywhere. In Savannah, the squares still exude a sense of the past. So that's there. But it was really in the rural South where we would, you know, see there'd be plaques every now and then. And then there were so few public taverns in the South that Washington was forced in many instances to stay at the homes of private individuals. And in several instances, those were really nice plantations in South Carolina. But all of those had been destroyed by Sherman's march. And many of them still lay in the rubble that were there with the live pine, the live oaks that once lined their roads in, still there. But they are not the magisterial places that Washington visited. And yet you get a sense of it. And then when we went inland, the forests are different and all of that. And yet you still, in some instances north of Camden, South Carolina, where the Battle of Camden was fought, in which Horatio Gates was humiliated by Cornwallis, they have planted longleaf pines in the area of the longleaf forest that was the battlefield of that battle. It's very evocative of not only what Washington would have seen as he came through on his tour, but of the battlefield that he was carefully studying, because he was absolutely curious about, because of what had been fought in the South while he was stuck for a large part in the Hudson River area. And so it was, the landscapes were very different, but in many cases you could find traces, whiffs of the past that were very helpful, particularly when you consulted his diary and put the two together.
I'm curious too, going back to regionality, of how different the locations were. I mean, you note that with these trips, he's in essence going on to 13 independent states and trying to unite them into a single nation. And that's incredibly strongly felt at this time period, because Virginia, for example, is a colony that is really set up in the 17th century. And its most prominent members are English royalists who, during the English Civil War, support the monarchy. A lot of the class division and essentially a caste system with slaves at the bottom and then poorer white laborers higher up and then wealthy landowners at the top is distinctly different from colonies set up in Massachusetts by Puritans, who would be considered religious dissidents, and they would be the parliamentarians during the English Civil War. So there are different branches torn asunder by different classes in English society that form different colonies in America, Catholics elsewhere, and then they have to be, these different branches have to be tied back in together. And we understand that with regionality, and we understand that the phraseology of the United States changes over time in the 19th century from the United States are to the United States is. But I think it's easy to lose sight of how that changes over time and how it's something that's always evolving and it's organic. So at this time in Washington's journey, can you give a sense of that regionality and how different one state or colony can be from another one?
Yeah, well, particularly, and Washington comments on the differences. And one thing to remember is we think of him as a Southerner. Yeah, he, you know, was born and lived in Virginia, but he had never traveled really south of his own state. He had just touched North Carolina prior to the Revolution, but had not been to South Carolina or Georgia. And so it was all new to him when he was on the Southern tour. And he actually knew New England much better because of his experiences during the Revolution. But he's observing what he's seeing, and what strikes him as he's in Connecticut, following the Connecticut River up into Massachusetts, he talks about the equality of the houses. The egalitarian nature of New England is striking to him, how each farm is you know, that typical New England farmhouse with about 100 acres, a few oxen, and everyone seems to be about, there's no real wealthy people, there's no real poor people. It's the sameness of the culture is striking to him. He goes south. It's obviously very different. You know, as you were describing, the hierarchy of Virginia and the rest of the South is very much in place. The planters have these huge, huge homes. Hampton Plantation in South Carolina still stands. It's now owned by the state. And Washington visited there, and it looks pretty much as it did when Washington was there. And this was a, you know, home of with close to 100 enslaved people. And then there were the poor whites around as well. And Washington comments on there are these plantations, but then there's really the houses that are in between are very humble, mud-daubed shacks in many instances, particularly when he goes inland. And, you know, there just aren't those big plantations up there because there isn't the agriculture for it. And so he comments on, you know, New England to him is very striking in its egalitarian nature. And in the South, he is, when he goes to South Carolina and Georgia, it's different from Virginia, but it's in many ways, it's kind of more of the same. And so it is striking to him. But I think what really surprised him as a Virginian was how once he got into the inland of Georgia and South Carolina and North Carolina, how terrible the roads were and how, as he would say, miserable the houses were. It was striking to him, something that he comments on several times. And so, you know, he was learning firsthand how the country varied region by region. And we think of today, we are the United States of America. And, you know, we think of ourselves as Americans, but that really wasn't the case before Washington set out on these journeys. You know, as you said, if you were the governor of Virginia, your country was Virginia. It wasn't this thing called America. And Washington's labor in making these journeys was to convince people to start thinking of themselves as something beyond their town or state as part of the United States of America.
And it's good to just not allow our 21st century ideas to infiltrate our idea of the past. And a counterpoint to regionality I heard recently really stuck out to me, and it wasn't a history description, but it was Alton Brown, who hosts a show on the Food Network called Good Eats. And he made a point that, at least from a culinary perspective, regionality doesn't really exist anymore in America, that the best Cuban sandwich he ever had was in California. And he went to Tampa, Florida, where the Cuban sandwich was invented by the Cuban immigrant community. And he said he couldn't find a good one there. In fact, regionality can hurt food because the food industry might rest on its reputation or laurels and not try to innovate anymore, which as a Kansas Cityan, I'm worried about our barbecue scene here, that we might just get a little bit too complacent. But good to remember, I mean, in distinction to how utterly different one region could be from another one in the 18th century. Well, with that challenge that Washington had, one thing that you note with your book is that he was worried that a future president might have the priority of dividing rather than uniting the American people, because he could see that that could be quite easy to do with how different and varied people's interests were. So what was his concern then, and how do you think that speaks to the challenges of today?
Yeah. In his farewell address, which was ghostwritten by Alexander Hamilton, it literally is his farewell address, what he's proud of, what he's worried about. And he does speak to for Washington, the focus of his life, the focus of his presidencies was creating the Union, the sense of a nation of states, not dominated by any one state, but all under a federal government. So the Union was paramount. And if this republic was going to last, in his view, the leader, the president, had to work to do everything he could to unite these disparate states, you know, with all their regional differences, and he had to unite them. But he talks about what if the president works the other way and actually exacerbates those divisions, this partisanship, how devastating that will be. He pretty much predicts a lot of the things we've seen over the last 5 years of how the civility of discourse deteriorates to the point where people are basically shouting at each other, and where he says passions have no place in a republic when it comes to discourse. If we are going to talk about our differences in an intelligent way, it creates divisions, he says, that a foreign power will inevitably attempt to utilize to their advantage in getting a foothold in our country. One thing we've seen with tampering in our elections. And so Washington, this really concerned Washington. You know, I think if he came here today, he would not be surprised by the partisan divide, by the stridency of our political divisions. By the end of his second term, it was just as bad in many ways as it is today when it comes to the venality of discourse. And Washington was really disillusioned by it. But I think what would trouble him are contemporary attempts to undercut the people's faith in the federal government, in the legitimacy of a government of laws, you know, to undermine those laws. Because he had spent 8 years attempting to establish a people's faith in that government, in those laws. And if the president and a good portion of the people begin to take a cynical skepticism towards that, that undercuts the very principle of a republic. And so I think, you know, there's a message from Washington from 230 plus years ago. It comes to that.
Yeah, very good point. And the elections after Washington, especially the election of 1800, was very ugly, too. So if there's any optimism in the fact that bitter partisanship is by no means new, America has been tested by that before, although Jefferson and Adams were far more eloquent in their insults than they are today. If that's anything we can try to rise to. Although a lot of their hatchet men weren't, so maybe that hasn't changed as well.
Yeah, it really got ugly, especially of that election. Washington, you know, had shuffled off the mortal coil. But on the other side of the War of 1812, with the demise of the Federalist Party, there was the era of good feelings under Monroe. And once again, the fires of partisanship would emerge. But it seems to be cyclical. And it gets bad, and then it gets a little, you know, so it's kind of goes with being a republic, I think.
Well, something to tie in a lot of these themes that you saw, both of Washington's story and then your own, as you experienced it for yourself. During your trip, you met tour guides, reenactors, and what you call keepers of history's flame. So what do you think were the best sites that, if people who read your book also want to experience for themselves, can also get a sense of the story if they see it with their own eyes?
Yeah. Oh, there's just so many places we went to. It's hard to choose favorites, but you got to start with Mount Vernon. The level of the interpretation, it's Washington, the person, but of course, something larger than that. And that's where our journey symbolically began and ended. And that's good. In New England, Sturbridge Village was not a place Washington stopped in, but he basically walked right by that area. And it's a historic early 19th century, late 18th century New England village. And you can see exactly the kind of architectural details that Washington's talking about when he's talking about the egalitarian notion of things. In the south, Old Salem, in what's now Winston-Salem, is a Moravian village that pacifists from Austria who wanted to trade, but also wanted religious freedom. Washington visited there. You know, here he is, the commander of the Continental Army. And he, instead of dressing in his military uniform, he's in his drab brown coat. And he spent 2 days at Old Salem. And the inn where he stayed is still there. And while, you know, sitting on the porch that's still there, he was serenaded by the Moravian brass band. And so that's amazing. Hampton Plantation, which I mentioned earlier, Washington visited there. He was actually apparently the first to go up the new steps of the porch that's been there ever since, built very close to this huge live oak where the owner suggested to Washington that she chop that tree down. It was, you know, just so close to the porch. And Washington says, you know, the supposed slayer of his father's cherry tree says, no, do not cut that tree down. It's too beautiful to be taken away. And it's still there today, a kind of living monument to Washington's visit. And so Charleston, Savannah, they exude history. They're full of plaques that speak to Washington's visit. And you put them all together, it's just was an amazing year and a half for my wife and I as we toured the country, but felt the presence of our first president.
All right. Well, there's a lot to take in. And for those who want to retrace that too, your book can be a good guide for them. They undertake it. And the name is Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. Now, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's great to talk.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening and see you next time.